The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today we will dig into the main theme of the February issue of Our State Magazine, which is all about jazz. There's a wealth of information, so let's see how much we can get into today's episode. The first article is Coltrane's High Point. Coltrane's High Point. The legacy of one of the world's most influential jazz musicians had its roots in the Piedmont city where he grew up, which has finally embraced this 20th century musical icon. When he furrowed his brow, the child's deep-set eyes were portals into another dimension. Sometimes, in the wee hours of the morning, he'd plop down in the backyard of his family's two-story Dutch colonial in East High Point and practice his clarinet until the sun peeped through the trees. The same notes and scales over and over and over. His neighbors in the middle-class black community of Griffin Park, the doctor's family next door, the dentist and teacher across the street, the minister down the road, they didn't seem to mind. They were accustomed to the quirks of this quiet preacher's grandkid with an old soul and an uncanny sense of focus. When John Coltrane blew into his horn, the abuses of Jim Crow era North Carolina couldn't hurt him. A couple of years later, in 1940, he'd take up the saxophone, and even then, later, his music would change the world. One of the loveliest sounds ever put to vinyl is the whimsical flight of Coltrane's soprano sax on Rodgers and Hammerstein's My Favorite Things. Recorded at Atlantic Studios in New York in October of 1960, the instrument starts out happy, swinging on the melody so familiar to anyone who recognizes it from The Sound of Music. The notes flutter like the wings of a sparrow diving over chimneys, soaring into treetops, winding wildly through windy alleys. But not even halfway into the nearly 14-minute epic, this simple show tune transforms into something very different, more like an Indian raga, all rhythm and drone, rumbling bass and percussion, hypnotic piano runs that alternate between the major and minor keys like a pacing animal trying to free itself from a cage. In Coltrane's hands, My Favorite Things becomes nothing short of a spiritual quest. What the jazz writer Ben Ratliff once referred to as the saxophonist's path toward the sublime. Phyllis Bridges bops in the concrete walkway leading to the front porch of 118 Underhill Street and turns around dramatically, hands lifted, palms to the sky. "And it all started here," she says. Her face stretches into a wild, childlike grin. The sense of wonder in her voice still palpable, even after years of working through bureaucratic red tape to get a historical marker placed on this hallowed ground. Bridges, who until recently served as vice chair of the High Point Preservation Society, is dressed in jeans and a white polo shirt, a curly afro framing her round face. She calls herself the unofficial gatekeeper of the Coltrane House. "I'm very protective of it," she says. "The first time I walked through this house, it was overwhelming, just seeing his grandfather's bookshelves still there in the living room." She trails and gasps. "I got chills." 13 years ago, when Bridges first began tracing Coltrane's early path in High Point, she wasn't really all that big of a fan. "To be honest, I didn't know much about John Coltrane," she admits. "I'd listened to some jazz, but I wasn't as deeply into it as a lot of people are." She'd recently opened a gallery, Yalik's Modern Art, which displayed, among other things, vintage black and white photographs of African American life in High Point before and during the Civil Rights era. The gallery eventually morphed into a gathering place. Seniors in the community would come in, huddle around the old photos, and excitedly point to the people and places that they remembered. Younger folks came too, wanting to know about the city's black history more than what they'd learned in school. A light bulb went off, Ridges said. I thought, this should be a gallery of African American history. The focus at Yalique's changed. Bridges became obsessed, digging for more detailed stories behind her images. She recorded interviews with elders who were eager to share their memories. One day, someone told her about the world-famous jazz musician who'd grown up just minutes from her own childhood home in the nearby Burns Hill neighborhood. I was like, wow, that's big. She scrunches up her face. And then I thought, but why didn't I know this? Her attention turned almost exclusively to Coltrane. She wanted to know who his parents and grandparents were, where he went to school and church, and most of all, where his childhood home was. She talked to the curators of the tiny Coltrane exhibit inside the High Point Museum. She scoured newspapers.com for old articles. She found out that just a few years earlier, in 2006, an 8-foot-tall bronze statue of the saxophonist had been erected at the corner of Commerce Avenue and South Hamilton Street downtown. Her sleuthing eventually led her to Coltrane's former home, sitting here on Underhill Street, unappreciated. Why, Bridges wondered, had it taken nearly 40 years since the saxophonist's death of liver cancer in 1967 for the city to adequately honor one of its most historically significant former residents? She turns and looks back at the front door, still cracked around the frame and painted a muddy red. Even now, she says, I don't think High Point really gets who lived here. How he changed jazz, how he changed music. 3 decades before he'd rewrite the rules of jazz on late 1950s and early 60s albums like Blue Train, Giant Steps, and A Love Supreme, John William Coltrane was born in the tiny Richmond County town of Hamlet on September 23, 1926. He was barely 3 months old when his parents, Alice and John Robert Coltrane, moved their newborn son to High Point. At first, they lived with Alice's parents and other relatives in a small house on Price Street near the St. Stephen AME Zion Church, where Coltrane's grandfather, the Reverend William Wilson Blair, served as minister. Coltrane was around 2 years old when Reverend Blair began building a 3-bedroom, nearly 1,600-square-foot home on Underhill Street for his expanding family. There, Coltrane grew up less than 5 minutes east, but a world away from High Point's busy downtown furniture district. His childhood home sat 3 lots north of Washington Street, then a busy hub of black-owned restaurants, stores, and businesses. There was the fancy Kilby Hotel, listed in the Green Book Guide for Black Travelers, and the First Baptist Church with its message in stained glass, "Enter to worship, leave to serve." 2.5 blocks west of Coltrane's house, an easy walk on a crisp fall morning, was William Penn High School, where he joined his first jazz combo. The school, a majestic red brick building established in 1910 by the Quakers for black students, still stands today and now houses the John Coltrane Hall of Music and Dance. The hotel and church are long gone, demolished after years of neglect. And the railroad tracks that run parallel to Washington Street between the Coltrane house and his former school sit beneath steep banks of kudzu. As preteens, Coltrane and his cousin Mary Lyerly, who was really more like a sister, roller skated all around Griffin Park, zooming down to the home of their friends Walt, Bertha, and Louise Williamson at the bottom of the hill. They may have even ventured into the sprawling Jack's Row slums that butted up against their more upscale community. They were kids. I'm sure they explored, Bridges says. And for them to experience growing up around professional people and well-educated people in this neighborhood, and then just a street over going back there and playing with the kids in that area, that must have been very eye-opening for small children. At home, Coltrane and Mary were surrounded by their grandfather's prodigious book collection and by the music that Coltrane's opera-loving mother would play on the family's upright piano. Coltrane's father, a local tailor, played music as well, violin and ukulele, by himself in his bedroom upstairs. Gathered around the radio, the family, which also included Mary's parents, Golar and Betty Lyerly, would listen to the popular singers of the day. Early on, Coltrane took up the alto horn and then switched to the clarinet that he got from Nash Jewelry, a pawn shop on Main Street downtown. He carried his instruments everywhere he went, out into the backyard, down to the neighbors' houses, and in several rooms of the family home. He would sit at the dining room table and practice, Mary remembered years later. He practiced all the time. In the winter of 1938, when Coltrane was just 12 years old, upheaval struck the family. Within the span of a month, beginning in late December, he lost both his grandfather and his father. 3 months later, his grandmother died. Coltrane was despondent. He buried himself more and more in his music. Shortly thereafter, he took up the saxophone because he was drawn to the warm and lyrical sound of Lester Young's playing on records by Count Basie and Billie Holiday. It was like a salve to his broken heart. After a while, Mary said, John couldn't even remember what his father looked like. He would say to me, Mary, what did Daddy look like? I would talk to him and I would tell him what he looked like. After the death of Mary's father 2 years later, only Coltrane, Mary, and their mothers remained in the home, and there was no more money coming in. Alice and Betty took jobs working for well-heeled white people at the Emerywood Country Club. Coltrane would go there occasionally and shine shoes for extra cash. The family rented out two of the upstairs bedrooms to help pay their bills. That same year, Coltrane joined the new school band at William Penn, and his constant rehearsing became part of the everyday ambiance. You could hear him all the time after school, from any other part of the building, back in the music room, practicing by himself, his classmate Rosetta Haywood recalled later. I think it was jazz. When Coltrane wasn't hyper-focused on his music, he was in many ways a typical teenager. He played football, he dated, and he and his buddies, Franklin Brower and James Kinzer, whom everyone called Poochie, were very style-conscious. Coltrane eventually got a job working as a soda jerk at the Washington Street Pharmacy to earn money to buy outfits that the kids called drapes. Zoot suit-like ensembles popular in Harlem at the time, at a local shop called Jacobs. He and Mary sometimes ventured down to the park where there was a dance floor, or over to the Kilby Hotel to see a swing band. During his senior year, Coltrane was voted most musical of his class. By then, his mother had left High Point for Philadelphia to find a better job and to live with relatives there. Mary and Betty moved to Newark. Coltrane stayed behind until graduation, living in his family's home alone, except for some boarders. On weekends, he and his friends would sit around and drink wine. When he finally graduated in May of 1943, he followed his mom to Philadelphia, where he continued his studies at the Ornstein School of Music. After a year's stint in the Navy that took him to Pearl Harbor, Coltrane's music career took off. He'd never again returned to High Point. Some say that Coltrane's memories of his final years in North Carolina during the Jim Crow era were so painful that he chose not to acknowledge his life in High Point. They point to interviews in which he'd say that he was born in Hamlet and leave it at that. Bridges thinks this may have been part of the reason why it took so long for High Point to acknowledge Coltrane. But efforts to honor the jazz great in the town where he grew up had begun as early as 1984, 1 year after the state legislature quietly passed a resolution recognizing Coltrane's contributions as a North Carolina-born artist. High Point leaders started talking about erecting a memorial and launching a jazz festival. It would take another two decades for real progress to begin. In 2006, the city unveiled its Coltrane statue downtown, and then 5 years later, the Friends of John Coltrane launched the annual John Coltrane International Jazz and Blues Festival. Still, the saxophonist's childhood home at 118 Underhill continued to languish. It didn't get its historical designation until just 5 years ago. Bridges had a lot to do with making that happen. And on August 30th, 2019, she was present when Michelle Coltrane, the saxophonist's stepdaughter, yanked the cover off the marker, and then put her hands to her face as she looked up and saw the words John Coltrane, world-renowned jazz saxophonist, lived with his extended family at 118 Underhill Street from 1928 to 1943. Michelle, who remembers sitting in her stepdad's saxophone case as a little girl growing up in their home on Long Island in New York, knew very little of his childhood in High Point. After the unveiling, she was the first person to step inside the house. "And I'm just thinking about what their everyday life was like here," she says, reflecting back on that summer day, "and knowing that there was a lot of loss in that house." She pauses and lets silence hold the space before continuing. "Yeah," she says in a whisper, "it was very, very touching." Bridges would like to dispel the myth, once and for all, that Coltrane ever really turned his back on High Point. Even after he moved north, he was surrounded by old friends from his childhood neighborhood. Brower and Pucci both moved to Philadelphia around the same time that Coltrane did. "He never forgot High Point," Bridges said. "He may not have come back, but he didn't forget the people he loved here, like the Williamson sisters." Before they died, the two women told Bridges that Coltrane had stayed in regular contact with them throughout his career, sending them copies of all of his latest albums. And when he would see someone from High Point at one of his shows, Bridges said, he'd give them a shout-out from the stage and reminisce with them after the performance. Even in his music, Coltrane alluded to his formative years. The second song on his groundbreaking 1960 album, Giant Steps, is a breezy tune called Cousin Mary, in which Coltrane's saxophone takes jaunty twists and turns like kids darting around corners and running through neighborhood yards. It's a sonic narrative of his and Mary's childhood escapades in Griffin Park. Coltrane's often chaotic improvisations were all about searching and questioning, remembering and confronting, not with words, but through sound. On A Love Supreme in 1965, his saxophone takes on the voice of a preacher from the pulpit of his youth, perhaps that of his grandfather, who spoke directly. Even in 1930s North Carolina, about pressing issues like discrimination and poverty. In the album's liner notes, Coltrane explains that on the final track, his saxophone sings the words of Psalm, a poem that he wrote, "Thank you, God. God is all. Help us to resolve our fears and weaknesses." Just a mile east of 118 Underhill Street, across the railroad tracks, sits Green Hill Cemetery. This is where you'll find some of High Point's most prominent African-American family names, those of doctors, teachers, veterans, and businessmen like John Kilby, who owned the Kilby Hotel. Bridges is standing in the cemetery's northeast corner over a gravestone that reads, "The Blair Family." She bends down and brushes dirt away from one of the markers. In crumbling letters is the name John R. Coltrane, the saxophonist's father. Nearby is the marker for Reverend Blair's grave and those of other family members. This is where John William Coltrane's physical path in High Point ends. But the path to the sublime, the one that jazz writer Ben Ratliff wrote about so eloquently in his book Coltrane, The Story of a Sound, that path will never end. In the years since Phyllis Bridges first learned that one of the world's greatest musicians grew up in High Point, she's become quite the jazz buff. Nowadays, when her own path in life gets rocky, she looks to Coltrane's music for solace. "My favorite song, my go-to, is Spiritual." She's referring to the song that in 1961, Coltrane adapted from the melody of the African-American spiritual, "Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen," written during slavery times. It's a sound of deep pain, of longing, of walking the path to what Christians call glory and Buddhists call nirvana. That's the song that Bridges trails off, eyes shut, hands clasped together as if about to pray. Well, it just moves you. It reaches deep inside you. You can feel what he's expressing, and it's deeply, deeply emotional. For more information about where to see landmarks from John Coltrane's childhood, contact the High Point Museum at 1859 East Lexington Avenue in High Point. And there's quite a few pictures that go with this article. I'll try and and share those with you. There's a picture of his him playing a saxophone. It's sort of a grainy black and white photo. And there's an inset picture, a very tiny one, of him as a little boy smiling. Then there's a picture of the aforementioned highway marker celebrating his life there in High Point. And there's a picture of Phyllis Bridges. Then we have a picture of the semi-restored childhood home. It says, for decades, Coltrane's childhood home in High Point languished in relative anonymity until in 2019, it received due recognition as a significant piece of the city's history. It's a craftsman-style home with brick pillars, brick and wood pillars, and a brown front door. And, it has a little small porch there. Then we have the bronze statue. High Point honors Coltrane's legacy with a downtown statue and the John Coltrane Hall of Music and Dance at his former high school, now the Penn Griffin School for the Arts. And it's a nice bronze statue, full body bronze statue with him holding his saxophone. And then on the opposite page, there's the Samuel E. Buford Auditorium of the John Coltrane Hall of Music and Dance, now the Penn Griffin School for the Arts, we mentioned. Coltrane's boyhood home was filled with music. Both he and his mother practiced on the family's upright piano, which traveled with the family when they moved to Philadelphia, and which is now on display at the High Point Museum. You can see the worn keys, which you imagine were lovingly played. The mural of John Coltrane in downtown High Point was inspired by his album covers, like the two that he recorded in his 30s. In 1961, Coltrane and his quartet headlined a jazz show for the ages at Carnegie Hall. And there it mentions New Year's Eve jazz at Carnegie Hall, Sunday, December 31st at 8:30 p.m., Sonny Rollins and Company and the John Coltrane Quartet. Also added attraction, the amazing Nina Simone, which we talked about in our last episode, and Thelonious Monk and his band. Ticket prices, I think you might find this interesting. It says the bar at Carnegie Hall will be open, and tickets were $3, $3.75, $4.50, and $5. Mail orders and box office now available. So that also a picture of the mural at the in downtown High Point, and it's three figures, assuming all three are of Coltrane. One is looking up. It's a dark background. It's very realistic looking. Whoever was the artist did a really, really good job. And one him with his head forehead furrowed, looking forward, and then one with him with his saxophone. And again, they're showing a couple of his album covers, Blue Train and A Love Supreme. And those were drawn as inspiration from there. Then we have the last photos are of the cemetery. Green Hill Cemetery in High Point is the final resting place of members of many prominent African-American families, including John Coltrane's grandfather, the Reverend William Wilson Blair, and Father John R. Coltrane, whose last name was actually misspelled on his tombstone. Interesting, it's spelled Coltrane, C-O-L-D-T-R-A-N-E. The D is not to be there. In the time that we have left, I'll read a couple of short articles that will give you some idea of where to go and hear some good jazz music in North Carolina. Gastonia native and world-renowned performer Maria Howell belts out the lyrics to Bill Withers' classic rhythm and blues song, Lovely, Lovely Day, while Noel Friedland plays a Yamaha Baby Grand piano, a fixture on stage at Middle C Jazz. Howell improvises, adding scat singing to the jazzy mid-tempo version of the song. The band members flow with spontaneity, following her vocals. Purple-tinted lighting sets the mood for the electric energy that buzzes through the air, inspiring guests seated at high-top tables to sway and tap their feet. Since opening in Uptown Charlotte in 2019, Middle Sea Jazz has featured internationally recognized artists, including many with North Carolina roots. Acts ranging from solo performers to 20-piece bands bring an eclectic schedule to performances to the venue. Entertainers engage with the audience by telling stories or asking guests to sing along. They perform familiar songs like by legends like Aretha Franklin and unexpected artists like Billy Joel and Steely Dan, and introducing new listeners to the jazz genre. Bass, piano, saxophone, and vocals work together to make old songs sound new. Venues like Middle Sea connect fans across the state to a rich musical heritage and create new jazz enthusiasts in accessible and comfortable environments. Sometimes the music is found where you might not expect it, in a vineyard, in a hotel lobby, a museum, a restaurant. But if you take a cue from jazz, you'll let the rhythm lead you wherever it goes. And you could check out jazz at Middle Sea Jazz at 300 South Brevard Street, Charlotte, North Carolina, 28202. And middleseajazz.com is the web address. We have some photos here. From 1944 through 1960s, the Excelsior Club was a political and social hub for Charlotte's black community and the place to hear good jazz. And so it looks like the Excelsior Club, they got a picture with a crowd standing in front of it getting their photo. And then inside, it's dressed in fancy dresses. Maybe it was a prom or just a fancy dress night where music and history were made in Charlotte. When Jimmy McKee opened the Excelsior in 1944, his goal was to create a private social club for the black community. It quickly became a hub for music, social engagement, and political discourse, says Maddie Marshall, a Charlotte resident and former club member. On Tuesday, she enjoyed the all-you-can-eat fish fry and played Bid Whist, a traditionally African-American card game similar to bridge and spades. The Excelsior Club was closed for in renovations in 2016, but it never reopened. For more information on the Excelsior Club, you can check out excelsiorclub.com. It was reopened in 2020 and is intended to be redeveloped as a place for history, music, and community gatherings. So hopefully that will actually happen. And for more information on that, check out excelsiorclub.com. We have run out of time today for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.